Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It was Wednesday, November 8, 1995. In London, Rupert Murdoch sat in his Wapping office opposite Kerry Packer. Fresh from securing a landmark deal to jointly broadcast horse racing across Australia, the two business titans were in a conciliatory mood. Among the items on the agenda that afternoon was putting an end to the battle for control of Australian Rugby League, in which Packer and Murdoch stood opposed. It was not the first attempt at brokering compromise in the messy war, but at last it seemed sanity would prevail. After all, if Packer and Murdoch could put their differences aside, what barriers could possibly remain? This is The Great Compromise, the 24th chapter in the Rugby League Digest in-depth investigation of the Super League War. Welcome back to the Rugby League Digest. I'm Michael Adams, here with Andrew Paskin. How's it going, Andy?
Mate, I'm over the moon to be back. How are you?
I'm good. I've kind of forgot my little intro line there. It's been a while. We've been working insanely hard on this through our little off-season. So thanks to everyone for sticking with us through our break. We're both so pumped about this upcoming season. What can I say?
Well, I think one party's been working harder than the other. You've been locked in a room like Howard Hughes.
But yeah, regardless, I say we because we are a team. And in correspondence with you over the last few days, I can feel the excitement. This is like our season kickoff. So I thought at the start we'd maybe explain what we've got in store for this, our second season of the Super League War. And basically, this season is going to cover the rugby league seasons of 1996 and 1997. And when you consider we had 23 chapters just on 1995, you can see that the action isn't as concentrated as it was in that single year. One of the criticisms we got from some circles was, when are they going to get to the Super League year? As if that was the heart of the drama. But in my mind, 1995 was such a monumental, explosive year that everything came after it kind of felt like a bit of the after story. So the pressure's really on to really nail the rest of this story.
Well, from reading the research that you've painstakingly compiled, I feel like it's even darker, the second series, because
yeah,
spirits are broken and there's a stalemate and all sorts of stuff. And, you know, it's really, really dark in my view.
There's a lot of twists and turns before we get to the actual Super League year of 1997. If the first season was framed around the April Fool's Day raid and all the fallout of that, season 1996 is bookended by two court cases. So those two court cases, the first case won by the ARL and then the appeal subsequently won by News Limited, they really form the heart of the first half of our season and then through to 1997 and the split competitions. So because the action isn't so concentrated, the format will change slightly over the next however many episodes. You'll get more multi-part episodes, probably less total chapters, but about the same amount of content overall. And that'll take us through to our third season, which will look at the reunification of the game.
Sort of.
So a lot of ground to cover. So we're going to get straight into it with the first chapter of season two. And this is really a table-setting exercise. So I mentioned that season 1996 revolved around these two court cases. This first chapter looks at the path to that first court case and all the opportunities to avoid it.
All of which were ignored.
Ignored is a bit strong, as you'll see. There were a lot of good intentions and a lot of earnest efforts to bring about compromise, but a lot of things had to fall into place for that to be achieved. And as you'll see, they just didn't. So let's start with this idea of the court. And basically, from the moment the loyalty agreements were struck in February 1995, the matter was always going to be settled in court. This is, of course, how the April Fool's Day raid was launched, with the ARL being served papers by News Limited challenging the loyalty agreements. You have to remember, of course, that the first shot fired during the April Fool's Day raid was the serving of papers to the ARL by News Limited challenging the loyalty agreements. The ARL subsequently filed counterclaims, and it all went down from there. So it's kind of funny how much duress there was on both sides. Like, you feel that the loyalty agreements and then the way News Limited signed their players, like, none of it was ever going to hold up in court?
Yeah, but that's my fondest memories of season one, just the harebrained pressure tactic.
But yeah, we're almost at the point of bidding farewell to Mike Coleman's Super League book, which has steered us so brilliantly to this point. That book ends shortly after the first court case. So you won't hear me quoting from it too much more over the course of our series, but one line I really liked in that talking about the upcoming court case was, "No matter the views of the players, the public, or the man on the gates at North Sydney Oval, those views would not decide a thing. In the end, it would be the law which decided whether Super League got off the ground or not." I really like that because of the way that, especially from the ARL side, it was just all this people power and we're going to rise up and Aussies for the ARL and all the rest of it, when really it was a bunch of lawyers from Sydney Grammar who were going to be deciding what was going to happen.
I mean, he couldn't have summed it up better, could he? And we all owe Mr. Coleman a debt of gratitude for that opus.
Absolutely. But throughout 1995, there was this disbelief in the media and definitely from the public. I remember feeling this myself, that surely it's not going to get that far. You know, let alone having two competitions playing, surely it's not even going to make it to court. They're going to come together and something's going to be done. And that was even written in news articles saying that, you know, there was a Rugby League Week article saying that the ARL had received legal opinion that there's a strong element of bluff in the News Limited challenge to the loyalty agreements. As if it was just this strong showing to, you know, get the ARL to capitulate and come to an agreement.
Well, I don't think you should be blamed or anyone else for thinking that, because in Rugby League, we're conditioned to think clubs are going to be bankrupt and on the 11th hour they're saved every time and, you know, that sort of thing. You just expected it to happen, didn't you?
Exactly. But it is kind of surprising that people thought that it wouldn't make it to court when so many big events and big changes in rugby league over the years have made their way to court and that's where they've been settled.
Yeah.
I read a great journal article in the James Cook University Law Review by Chris Davies called Rugby League and the Law, which went through a history of court cases involving rugby league. So we can all name the big ones, you know, obviously the seminal Tuddy case, the draft in the early 90s, through to Super League itself. The big one after Super League that will be a big part of our last series is the Souths case. But it just seems that so many times along the course of rugby league's history, something has ended up in the courts that has reshaped the game or had an opportunity to reshape the game. I didn't really want to go too heavy on the seminal ones, the really important ones. When you think of, say, the Tuddy case, which has been covered elsewhere, I'd recommend everyone once again check out The Professionals, which you can see at nrl.com, looking at the history of the Rugby League Players Association. That's a must watch. These kind of cases, they've been covered in part elsewhere, but they would really take a lot of work for us to do justice to. But in Davey's article, he used a few examples which really stood out to me as being kind of interesting and worth a few minutes to talk about. The first couple I wanted to discuss was the idea of defamation in rugby league, which Davies makes the case that in Australian legal terms is something that seems to only happen in rugby league, these defamation cases.
What do they do? Go to Your Honour, I would submit that the plaintiff is in fact a gibberer.
Well, the one that really stood out to me was almost exactly along those lines, which was the case of Boyd v. Mirror Newspapers. That is Les Boyd, of course. And he took a defamation action in regard to the headline, "Boyd is fat, slow, and predictable." So he actually lost that case, with the reason being that it was found to not be disparaging of Boyd.
I thought truth would have been the defense.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. Like, I can understand him losing the case, but I would put it to you that that is disparaging.
Well, actually, he's not predictable because he could hit you with an elbow in the jaw at any time. So, like.
And the other big defamation action was the famous ET nude photo taken in the dressing rooms during the 1990 Kangaroo tour, which is one I definitely remember from childhood.
Yeah, I remember it being shocking at the time, but I mean, it's been covered in our podcasts regularly, but back to the old show, but the old trope is you have to be able to identify your doodle if you're suing for the nude shot and you couldn't do it.
But he did win that case. And again, I'm no legal expert, but it seems funny that it was defamation.
Yeah, usually it's like print words, isn't it?
Yeah. One of the main thrusts of Davey's argument was that rugby league is subject to more court cases than any other Australian sport. And there was a bit of discussion about why that is. And, you know, you're the legal mind of this show. Do you have any opinions on this?
Well, I actually, drawing on my Newcastle sort of working class experience, really, is that it's the attitude of the people involved in it. Like, most of these cases are spite cases. I'm going to get that bastard type of thing, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
people that won't back down, want to prove a point. The lawyers advise settling because it's going to cost too much money. Like, I don't care what it costs, I'm going to get this bastard.
It's funny you say that, because a lot of the other examples cited by Davies were the ones of on-field incidents ending up in the court. You know, so it's just a continuation of something that happened on field. You know, you've got the Stephen Kearney and Jared McCracken case, the Gary Jackie and Roberts one.
Well, my mate and mentor, Chris Murphy, represented Jackie in that one. And
oh, really?
He still despises Ian Roberts to this day for that, yeah, action. Right. Real dog act.
I was thinking about it as well, and I had the idea that one of the reasons might be that rugby league is one of the few sports whose right to exist has been called into question from the very start, and that's remained a relevant question, you know, 125 years later.
Yeah.
It's like this constant battle to prove that, you know, we have a right to exist. It seems to me that there'd be something in the DNA that lends itself to needing to prove things.
Absolutely. It's the underdog mentality. And as we know in the Rugby League Digest, in rugby league, you can't bully the underdog. Like, with the Super League War itself, like any other sport would have just capitulated under that sort of pressure from News Limited.
Yeah. And that's a good way to get to the rest of our episode, because, of course, it was nominally the ARL in court against News Limited. But they wouldn't be there without the largesse of their corporate overlords who, you know, funded this war and kept it going. And a lot of what we're going to see over the course of this episode is how those influences and tensions pushed forward and ultimately derailed compromise attempts. So what we're going to be looking at in this episode is the attempts made throughout 1995 to reach a compromise and to end it before it ended up in the courts. It was funny, in the aftermath of the first court case, in the aftermath of the Super League season itself, there was a lot of introspection from all parties, a lot of regret and, you know, musing about the way things could have gone, if things could have been different. And a big part of that was that February meeting that we covered in the first season. So there was a lot of ruminations, you know, Arthurson saying, why couldn't they have just made a deal, all the rest of it. I'm sure the parties involved who put up $500 million fighting this war would have also had that same sense of regret. So Arthurson, for example, in the Rugby League Week in 1996 said, "The saddest part about it is this. The whole thing could have been fixed with a minimum of fuss and hundreds of million dollars less in costs. The bottom line would have been a deal that would have been to everybody's satisfaction." And I mean, that sounds great and we should have done that. It's kind of ignoring the fact that in February, no party was willing to give any ground.
He's rewriting history there a bit, isn't he?
Yeah. And I mean, his comments in that respect are lacking in introspection, given he basically told the clubs at that February meeting that he wasn't interested in the Super League proposal. But on the other hand, it also demonstrates the ARL's impotence. If a deal was to be done, it was at that stage going to be done between Packer and Murdoch. You know, it didn't really have anything to do with the ARL even at that point. But at the same time, it's hard not to sympathise with the ARL, given the terms that were offered were so in News Limited's favour, especially with what became the sticking point all year, the fact that the ARL didn't really have a seat at the table in terms of total control of the competition. They would be there to administer the competition, but it was all News financing and, you know, reaping the profits and ultimately controlling the competition. That was something that News wouldn't budge on, and it was something the ARL couldn't accept.
The whole thing about, you know, all we want to do is run the game, but they also wanted power as well, and they just keep glossing over that.
I do sympathise with the ARL in that respect. That's a really hard deal to accept, where you're basically handing over control of the game that your organization had run in Australia for, you know, 9 years at that point.
Well, they couldn't do it conscionably for their own constituents, could they? Like, they couldn't say that they're fighting for the clubs and they go, well, we're going to sign over and, you know, 80, you're going to die. But I mean,
exactly.
In the same respect, they got the game into that position as well. So they couldn't really be demanding too much power, could they?
Yeah, exactly. And it comes down to something that I feel we may have been too flippant about in just, you know, claiming that, you know, like Optus, Foxtel News Limited, what does it matter? The ARL were at the behest of these money men. But the difference is that by going against News Limited and accepting the money from Optus, accepting the money from Packer, it was still their competition. And I think that is more than semantics, that ultimate question of ownership. I do think it's something that maybe we haven't grappled with. We haven't put enough gravity on that.
I think you're probably right. But like, I mean, let me ask you this. How much is the fact that Murdoch is the face of News Limited, how much of that is just disdain for him, you know, like his brand, you know what I mean? Like if it was some other company, if it was Kerry Stokes, you know?
I mean, you say that, but, you know, the ARL were on the verge of a deal with News Limited in 1994. The Telegraph was long, you know, you call the Newcastle Herald a Knights fanzine. You know, the Telegraph wasn't much better in terms of covering the New South Wales Rugby League prior to the Super League War. Yeah. So there was a long-standing connection, and blokes like Peter Frelingos were, you know, really tight with the league. So I think from the ARL's point of view, all the disdain for Murdoch came afterwards.
Interesting, yeah.
But for all that, what was offered by Super League at that point, Ken Cowley suggested that basically the traditional clubs would be retained with a Sydney comp that operated under Super League, and, you know, the clubs would have a stake in the four Sydney franchises. That's probably the best way for it to have broken down when you think about everything else that happened and all we went through.
I just wonder what would have happened fan-wise if that had come to pass, whether the four Sydney franchises would be have empty stadiums and all these minor league foundation clubs would have packed suburban terraces.
It's hard to know. And in my notes, I put the comparison of the BBL. You know, we're a decade down the track, but is anyone really passionate about any of the teams? I don't know if that's an accurate or a fair comparison.
I don't think it is, because BBL is like a World Sevens or International Nines version of the game, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, the other one I put was the A-League, which I think there is something there. You had a move from these, you know, smaller, largely ethnically based teams, you know, Marconi, Sydney Olympic, all the rest of it, into these new entities spread out across Australia that I think in 15 years or however it's been, have developed a real, you know, genuine fan base and genuine passion.
Yeah, even that, I mean, soccer fans are just like, you know, looking for something to be passionate about, you know. They want to be singing together and punching each other and all the rest of it.
As much as I agree with you, I also think that it's kind of beside the point. The fact is that each team has 10,000 of those people.
Yeah.
So with a sport that was already very popular in New South Wales and Queensland, what could we have done with a model similar? But I don't want to get too far into what could have happened. I just wanted to set the scene that the February meeting was viewed with a lot of regret. And, you know, the big thing we're going to come back to is what would have happened if Packer didn't come in and make a big show and say that he owned the rights, he ran rugby league in Australia, and, you know, everyone else could piss off, I'll sue the pants off you, etc.
Paper the walls with writs, I believe he said.
Yeah, exactly. So that led to the famous front door comment from Ken Cowley to Arthurson saying that if we were going to try this again, we'll definitely come through the front door. Of course, they went another way and April Fool's Day happened. After April Fool's Day, it led to a genuine effort on the part of Cowley and Arthurson to come to an understanding. And they had a lot of meetings over the next couple of months to try to work something out.
All through this story, we see the, for all his faults, Arthurson's just a rugby league man. It warms the heart.
It warms the heart, but it also shows you the limitations of having a rugby league man in charge, you know, and I mean, that's the way it always was. And credit to the ARL and Arthurson and Quayle in particular, they got the game to that point. But when the game was so popular that you had media titans battling over it, you've got to be up for the fight. And I think the limitations of having rugby league men in charge really hindered the ARL at this point. And I mean, that can be seen by Cowley's comments regarding Packer having the pay TV rights, which he, you know, got for next to nothing, and then on sold to Optus, which the ARL had nothing to do with. So this was Cowley's quote in Roy Master's book, Inside Out. Ken asked me this morning, what can I do about it? And I said, I've got no idea. But I said, I suppose the short answer is, did you stamp the money? In other words, did the ARL maintain control over TV rights? You say Nine have now assigned the license, pay-per-view rights, to Optus Vision. Did they ask you to do that? Was that put to the board of the ARL? He said no, and I said, pretty bloody sloppy.
Accurate.
But that was just one part of, by all reports, a fairly congenial and productive month of talks between Arthurson and Cowley, who were always positioned as the two Kens, the two old-school friendly gentlemen who could, you know, sit down despite their differences and work towards a common goal. And it seemed that they were making real headway for genuine compromise. It was still the main issue that would ultimately derail all talks, the question of ownership of the game. Arthurson's second sticking point, which is really brutal and heartbreaking in light of everything that happened, was, as he said in May 1995, the second sticking point is that we have a legally binding contract with Channel 9, which we are obliged to and wish to fulfill.
Tragic.
And the biggest part of the talks were what was going to happen to the Sydney clubs. You know, how were you going to solve this problem that needed to be dealt with? And Arthurson at this point was actually agreeable with the idea that something could be done. But his big thing was time, that it couldn't just come together instantly, that, you know, you needed a kind of 3-year transition period or something similar, which it sounds sensible, it sounds right and reasonable. But the issue is that the ARL were always seemingly 3 years away from revolutionary change.
For 100 years, yeah.
Yeah. They bring in the 20 teams, but, you know, that's only going to be for a couple of years while the competition settles down, like whatever that means. You know, instead of making the hard choices then, it was, well, let's have this transition period. And then at this point, he's also offering this transition period of give us 3 years to sort it out, as if clubs would then take that 3 years to amalgamate themselves.
Well, it's funny because everything else they do is just a snap decision. You know, we're going to get a limited tackles or whatever. You know what I mean? But when it comes comes to clubs, it's the longest drawn out thing ever.
But then look at the way it ultimately broke down. You know, they were told that it was going to be, you know, 16 teams, 14 teams. And it's like, okay, shit, we better merge then. And then it was done. They merged. I kind of think that shotgun marriages seem to be the only way to get clubs into bed with each other.
Yeah.
When you look at the way it broke down in, you know, 98, 99. But contrasting the two Kens were the two Johns, Quayle and Rebo, who were quite decidedly not old school gentlemanly in their approach to the media and to dealing with conflict. And you can see that especially from Rebo. He was quite intransigent throughout the whole process, saying, we're not looking at compromise. We're full steam ahead. This Super League has the sizzle about it. And, you know, at various points, being completely rebuffed by statements in the press from Ken Cowley. So there seemed to be a disconnect between the top of News Limited and Rebo at Super League at times.
It blows me away a bit with Rebo that he had that sort of, the old phrase, face like a smacked ass, you know, like the whole time. And his communication was like gruff and arrogant and whatever. It's like, he's like one of those coaches that gets the job and then loses the dressing room straight away. Like, just having a more conciliatory tone even would have helped, you know? Like,
I just think he believed in Super League that much.
Yeah.
Like, he really believed in it. And maybe the way the public fallout throughout April, that had to have affected him. And I think maybe he just got into this back against the wall kind of defensiveness. And similarly, Quayle, who, despite being, you know, quite open to compromise, you know, many statements in the press saying, well, you know, the door's open, I'm standing by the phone, we're willing to talk. I feel like with Quayle, there was maybe a bit too much water under the bridge. The way he puts it, you know, the Brisbans and Canberras didn't like him because he was the one who delivered the nose.
My door's always open so I can stare at you aggressively.
But to his credit, when, you know, basically from April Fool's Day, it was always said that any compromise would involve Quayle's head on a platter, he repeatedly said that he was quite willing to make that sacrifice if it would bring about change, saying, look, if it's about me, I'll go. Let's just get this sorted.
A real man's man, a real rugby league man. I love that about him. But look at the language they're using, like it's life or death, you know.
Yeah.
Want his head on a platter. Take it easy.
But beyond the characters involved, the other thing was looking at what compromise would look like how rugby league would be reshaped if they did come to an agreement. And I think it illustrates why it would have ultimately been difficult to achieve. It was kind of too many half solutions that wouldn't end up pleasing anybody. The biggest one of which was what came to be known as the Singleton solution or the Singleton plan. Further evidence of John Singleton's strange relationship with rugby league that we still haven't been able to put our finger exactly on what his interests were. Although I did realise that he had the advertising account for the ARL through 1995. So he did have a vested interest. But he's just a funny character because he's known as like a, you know, an ARL man and someone who was sympathetic to them. You know, obviously his interest in Wes and his idea that Super League would be a pathway to give Tommy Ronicus a job for life.
But he loves an Oxford scholar too, so he pulls some of the benefits of it.
And at the same time, he was very sympathetic to the characters of Super League. This quote on Rebo and Paul Morgan. John Rebo and Paul Morgan rate as two of the brightest guys in the game, and they were treated like shit. Rebo will be seen by some as just a wrecker in all this, but he's a totally honest, decent bloke who was vastly underestimated and was treated very poorly. He was frozen out. And as part of his ARL man who could see the benefits of Super League, he came up with a solution that was kicking around the league. I'm pretty sure it would have been doing the rounds even before April Fool's, but basically, it was to separate the league into tiers. He wasn't the first and by no means the last to suggest that idea. There's too many different things to go into, but basically, it would be a top eight that involved five teams from the first tier and three teams from the second tier. And to get to that ranking in 1996, there'd be like a six-round Challenge Cup style tournament.
Sounds ridiculous. I mean, A, they'll never rest until someone gets a Super Bowl style conference final happening in the rugby league. It's almost like the hybrid game. It's mentioned that much, but none of these things work unless it's symmetrical. You can't have five from one and three from the other.
Well, if you think that's bad, like how do you feel about the next idea suggested? And basically, like from here on in, the Singleton plan evolved to mean that any suggestion that came up was just tacked on to the Singleton plan. So it ended up wildly different to what he originally suggested. But once Cowley and News Limited came into the mix, it did become the idea of using these tiers to create two separate competitions. So having the Super League and then a Sydney competition, which one idea was to call this the JJ Gilton and Shield, and that would just involve the traditional Sydney clubs, but it had a promotion and relegation element where the winner of the JJ Gilton and Shield would be promoted to the top tier, Super League. But who could be relegated? Only the lowest ranked of the four Sydney teams.
I mean, can we go back to Northern England from the 1970s style comp, please?
Like, have you heard anything more ridiculous? A relegation system where only four of the 10 teams are eligible for relegation?
Yeah. I mean, one thing about rugby league I love is if anyone's got an idea, like they'll get a chance to air it. The papers will say, well, Trevor Gilmus has got an idea to revamp the scoring system, whatever. Everyone gets heard. It's great.
But beyond the obvious reasons why this would fail and be terrible, I feel if they had gone with something like that, and this is my opinion of promotion and relegation in general, I feel we may have got ourselves stuck in the same cycle of the English Super League, where it's like, okay, promotion and relegation for these few years, and then, oh, wait, no, we want to go with a licensing model now, so no more relegation. Oh, but wait, this isn't really working, so now we're going to do it again. And
oh, God, yeah.
I just think, A, it's not the Australian sporting culture, and B, it's not solving the right problem.
But think about like how paranoid rugby league people are in general. When everything's totally legit, they still think they're being hard done by. If you were one of the four and the other clubs were exempt, it would have been a concrete cancer in the game.
Oh, my God. Like, what we experienced through Super League and beyond is nothing compared to what we would have got if, you know, like, West fans were outraged because Adelaide won two games and they won three, but West were being relegated, you know? Like, nightmare.
Imagine being a ref in that comp. But, I mean, if it went that way, it would have been 5 years before we were having barter sponsorships.
Yeah. But as you said, any idea gets discussed in rugby league. And the fact that these ideas were on the table and being talked about meant that in the public eye, there was a real sense that something was going to be done. And the way it was reported in the media, late April, it was viewed as inevitable that there'd be a compromise. But that quickly changed. And again, neither party would give any ground of the real sticking point about ownership of the game. So what was inevitable in late April, by early May had become tenuous, unlikely by late May, and then by the end of June, it was basically off the table. So John Rebo came out and said, "It's too far gone to talk compromise now. The battle's over. We've got our competition, they have theirs. Let's stop the sniping and get on with the business of running them."
He must have felt confident with the players they had that they were going to outlast them at that point in time.
See, to me, that is bluster. I think that's mainly bluster from Rebo, because they must have been privately panicking that they hadn't got the teams and players that they thought they were going to get. You know, as we saw in our the 10th chapter, the way they were scrambling to get those places filled, I think there's an element of just tough talking by Rebo in that instance.
Yeah, right. Well, if you can't get the clubs you want at 12 midnight in a seedy hotel, when can you get them?
But I think by that point, Rebo had been given the word from News Limited that, you know, get ready for the courts, get ready for dual competitions. Compromise isn't happening. And that became clear finally in September when Ken Cowley said, "I don't think it's possible, unfortunately. I know that Kerry Packer and myself are both at one. We both care about the game. All along, we've been keen that something would happen, but it seems to be out of our control now." I think with that quote, you can see a subtle hint about the third party, which is Optus, of course, which had curiously taken a back seat in the press, despite the fact that they were the only party really able to bring about compromise on the ARL side. They were very much the deciding factor. And over the back half of this episode, we'll increasingly see their influence and their role in, you know, stopping compromise.
It just makes me sick, this whole Optus thing. It really does.
Yeah, well, just make sure you're sitting down for the back half of the episode, because it is infuriating. But with that, come September, semi-final time, compromise was looking unlikely. And because of that, the two camps were on a war footing. So in Super League's eyes, what a perfect time to launch their competition on the eve of ARL semi-finals. So they launched their comp with a gala event at the Museum of Contemporary Art in early September 1995.
They were trying to get away from rugby league traditionalists, weren't they?
Well, Ken Cowley's statement on why the MCA was chosen was, "The Museum of Contemporary Art represents the very best of innovation and imagination, and Sydney Cove was the place where modern Australia was born. Today we celebrate not only innovation and sporting imagination, but will be envied by future generations as being privileged at being present at the birth of Super League."
It's a very nice spot there, actually, but I mean, it's not exactly rugby league.
To me, and this is disparaging of people like Ken Cowley, who I don't think is a dumb guy, but to me, it's a classic, like, dumb guy thing to do to show that you're smart and you're highbrow now. You know, you can think about the ARL like having like orchestras and Yanni for their season launches in the past. It's, you know, this telegraphed attempt to class up the game.
But then they couldn't have it at like the bistro at the Captain Cook Hotel either. You know? Hiding to nothing.
It was a early Monday morning event, so I think it would have been some kind of, you know, buffet or canapé kind of thing. So how many times do you think you would have heard the words, "How good's the spread?" The event was to culminate in the revealing of the Super League logo, which was going to be a helicopter bringing it down to Circular Quay, but that was deemed too dangerous. So they actually filmed parachutists coming down to land, which they did prior and played at the season launch.
Still, it's a great logo.
The logo's okay. I'll pay that. A bit Mickey Mouse doing the pre-filmed parachute drop of it, I think, maybe.
Well, do you want a bloke dying on the launch or a tourist getting hit in the head by a Super League sign? Did we not learn anything from, well, that was before that, the Optus vision?
But launching the season at this time I can understand the all's fair in love and war element of it, but like, it's a dick move to me.
It really is. I think the Rugby League people would have seen it that way too, or would have felt off.
Yeah, I think it was counterproductive and it's just bad PR. It doesn't make Super League look good.
Petty.
Yeah, petty, and everyone could see it from what it is. One of the things I liked about it, though, was at the same time they had the launch, they revealed the proposed draw for 1996, and that led to outcries about the unfairness of it from certain teams. One report in the Rugby League Week said that Auckland have been stiffed by a bizarre Super League draw. It's like early indication that for all of the circus element to it and the vision and all the rest of it, it was going to be just a rugby league competition.
Before it even exists, they're complaining about it. Beautiful.
But that was basically where the two camps stood at the end of season 1995. So the court case kicked off just after the grand final and all the filthy four case and all the little sideshow cases that were going on. We, of course, had the World Cup before the judgment came down in February of 1996. Before we got to that, however, there was probably the most significant efforts at compromise and the one that really could have stopped the war right then and there. And that is what I referenced in our opening monologue, which was the meeting on November 8 between Kerry Packer and Rupert Murdoch in London. And this coming together of the two had been telegraphed from some point before that, in the wake of the World Rugby Corporation collapsing, which, if you haven't, go back and listen to our The World in Union chapter, and the Sky Racing deal done between Packer and Murdoch to basically run racing on TV in Australia. So with those sorted out, it was just reported and viewed in the public that, oh, okay, well, they've got together on these things, so surely rugby league is next on the agenda and we'll just solve it all.
I was fascinated by both these blokes as a young fella, read all the books about them. But just the thought of these two Bond villains, just it's just like a little personal bet for them to see who wins. Yeah. You know, it just sucks.
And I think you've probably hit the nail on the head there with just how much of a compelling and easy narrative it was to frame it in those terms. And so at this point in time, it was very much considered a Murdoch versus Packer battle in the public eye. And I feel this is something the rugby league media really should have done a better job of correcting. It's easy with hindsight, but I found myself like really disappointed with the media, like serious journalists who just made out that it was this two-man battle for control and, you know, Optus or pay TV had nothing to do with it really.
But it sells more papers when it's Packer Murdoch instead of Murdoch Jeff Cousins.
Yeah, exactly. But regardless, this meeting in November between the two did have a chance to really get things going. And of course, ending the Super League war was just one item on the agenda. The other big part of it was a deal between Channel 9 and Fox to get, you know, Fox movies and TV shows on Channel 9. So that was like probably even a bigger deal than Super League was sorting that out.
But I mean, yet again, it's all about pay TV, mate.
It's so funny that that deal, as we'll see, the deal didn't go through at that time. It was eventually settled, you know, in late 96 or early 97. But the deal was basically completely redundant by the time it was all settled. And I think there's an irony there in the fact that the whole rugby league affair was over pay TV rights. And it was pay TV that effectively killed the, you know, the Sunday night premiere movie tradition, which was seen as this big carrot when Kerry Packer was, you know, trying to do a deal with Rupert Murdoch to get the rights.
It's just annoying that they're bartering over City Slickers too, and then and this little side bet on the game we love. You know?
Yeah, exactly. So I won't go too far into, you know, the terms of the deal and 15% of this and 5% of this. That's not really relevant to our story. All we need to know is that Murdoch and Packer reached a deal. Part of that was to try to settle the rugby league war, to try to get that done. So following this meeting, a compromise agreement was drawn up by Kerry Packer's right-hand man, Brian Powers, and he'd met with the two Kens in Sydney to discuss a solution. This took place at the Astor Apartments on Macquarie Street. But basically, this was step two of the road to compromise. So step one was an agreement between Packer and Murdoch. Step two was to get the ARL and News into some kind of agreement about what compromise could look like. And then we'll get to step three soon. But so basically, This compromise once again came back to control of the game. All the agreements that were drawn up, so they proposed that two-tiered agreement. They proposed a relegation promotion system. News were adamant that no Super League teams could be relegated. So now you've got the even more ridiculous situation of only ARL teams being eligible for relegation. A big sticking point was the existence of the Hunter Mariners and Adelaide Rams, so Super League wouldn't give any ground on the place of those two teams in the competition.
What would they want to keep the Mariners around for?
This is, to me, the most damning argument against News Limited being genuine about compromise. Not budging on these ridiculous measures, they knew that the ARL weren't going to accept that. Why would the ARL agree that only their clubs could be relegated? Why would they agree to two teams in Newcastle?
So that's what I mean. It couldn't have been all bluster, because otherwise they would have had some sort of genuine attempt.
Yeah.
Crazy. You know what we haven't spoken about is they was planning on running this without any gambling money, poker machine money, whereas every club to date is surviving just on that and still going broke. So they were expecting such profits from this pay TV that they didn't need any.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that was all the talk from the Super League pitch, was that, you know, oh, we'll own the clubs, but you can buy your stake back. And with the way our profits are going to work, you'll be able to buy it back within 4 years. So as the talks kept going on, it was even put to the clubs. And the way it was reported, there was an idea that clubs would be willing to, you know, amalgamate, or various solutions were offered. One of those was that the Super League Sydney clubs would be retained and the ARL clubs would buy minority stakes in those clubs. So
pyramid scheme style vibe to that. You just buy your stake back in 4 years. Yeah. Bizarre.
And these reports of clubs being willing to amalgamate themselves and come to an arrangement was offset by comments such as this one by an ARL executive. Has any airline ever offered a half share to a hijacker? That's exactly what's happening here.
That's the quote of the series.
But so I think it would have been really hard to get the clubs to come up with an arrangement that worked. But the other thing that I think is interesting about this is, at this point, the ARL were publicly acknowledging the need to do something about Sydney. So Arthurson said that cutting the number of teams was a problem we have to get around.
If you're one of those clubs and he's preaching about, you know, we're going to fight them on the beaches like Churchill, and then suddenly comes out and says that, you'd just be shattered.
Well, that's the thing. I feel like the ARL kind of blew with the wind on amalgamations. Mm. At various points saying, yep, we know we're going to rationalise, we're going to give the new comp time to settle in, then we're going to get to work, or we know this is a problem we need to fix. And then at other times being like, this is our tradition, Super League are coming in, but we've got to be loyal to our clubs.
It's like the Origin jersey thing. We're going to be traditional, but here's our newfangled jersey. So it's
yeah,
like,
yeah.
But being one of those like low clubs like West Magpies and being described as a problem that needs fixing.
Yeah, yeah.
Sorry.
So yeah, it was definitely expedient for the ARL at certain points in the war to be conciliatory and talk about rationalisation, and at other points be, you know, steadfast in tradition and the need to protect their clubs. But I mean, all those statements are in the press, all these contradictory statements. And how, as a club boss, could you have any faith in your long-term future with that?
Well, the only sensible guy in the whole thing so far has been George Piggins. I'll be as loyal to you as you are to me.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But basically, what happened was the talk stalled, as they always did, because of these tough terms and the fact that the compromise agreement News Limited were offering in November was basically unchanged from what they pitched in February.
Yeah.
But as all this was going on the 24th of November, it was reported that Channel 9 had secured a deal for the free-to-air rights of Super League.
Anomaly.
This was viewed as treachery by the ARL. They couldn't believe that Packer had done it. You know, Arthurson in particular was gutted by it. You know, you could see in his book how personally affected by it he was and how much he considered it a betrayal.
Well, there's no other way to describe it, but it goes back to your point about rugby league men and handshakes and everything when you're dealing with these sharks. I mean,
yeah, and I mean,
grandmother for 5 cents.
Exactly. And you have to think that the talks in November were about Packer getting the best deal for himself. That was always going to involve Channel 9, like his one true love.
Mm. But can we just acknowledge now this pack of the knockabout narrative? Can we just forget that from now on? Because
I just cannot believe how that perception managed to last for so long. Like, even when he was being talked about as a prick and a snake and all the rest of it, it was always this, you know, like, oh, he loves a punt, he loves his cricket, etc. And it's like, well, he's old money, he grew up playing polo, all the rest of it. Like you couldn't get any further removed from the common man than Kerry Packer.
Well, it just goes to show how much people hate nerds, because like most businessmen are nerds, like Rupert Murdoch. So, because he wasn't a total nerd, and was like, what a legend.
And I mean, even Ken Atherton, like in his book, after all of this had happened, you know, I'll spoil that Kerry Packer does a second deal with Rupert Murdoch in 1997 that also broke Atherton's heart. After all of this, Atherton writes, I would venture to say that Rupert Murdoch has never seen a game of rugby league. I certainly haven't bumped into him on the hill lately, having a pie and a beer. At least Packer is a sporting bloke. Like, this bloke ripped your heart out twice. And you're like, oh, he's a sporting bloke at least.
Loves a punt too.
But for all the ARL's blindsiding and talk of treachery when this deal was announced, in the press, it was still reported as just being part of the process, something that was going to hasten the peace. Even John Rebo was quoted as being amenable now. He said, time's running out for both parties, so if there's going to be a compromise, I believe it will be by the end of next week. So we were almost moving into fait accompli terms in the press once this deal was announced.
Yeah.
But at this point, we're going to really introduce Optus in a serious way. And it's kind of like, as all of this was playing out publicly, as deals were being considered, as, you know, statements were flying around in the press between Packer and Murdoch, the final boss was laying in wait. And all the public comments we got from Jeff Cousins, who was the boss of Optus Vision, this should have been an indication that it was going to take a lot of work to get an agreement over the line. So he was regularly quoted in the press throughout all these talks as saying, well, we haven't agreed to anything, and we have no intention of giving up our rights to the Australian Rugby League. But we should take just a moment to set up the state of play in Australian pay TV at that time, with Optus considered, you know, being somewhat ahead of the game at that point.
That's just hilarious to me. I always thought of them as like the undersized runt, you know, the pay TV litter.
But I wonder how much of that is shaped by the way it all played out. Like, you know, history only remembers the winners, you know, so we think of Optus as being beaten, but, you know, at this point in time, they were doing well. But what everyone knew was that there could only be one ultimate victor. But the other big selling point of Optus Vision was the fact that, in the public eye at least, they had Packer in their corner. So it was considered, you know, Packer's operation. The reality was he owned a 5% stake, which, there were these deals in place that it was going to go up to 15 and then I think even 30% at one stage. But he ultimately chose not to exercise that.
When I read that in your notes, I nearly fell off my chair. And not just because of obesity, because of all this bullshit over 5% stake in Optus Vision.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
And I think what it ultimately shows is that his heart was never in the fight. I think even the fact that he had that 5%, I view it in the same light as that February dick swing at the meeting. He wanted to come in and mark his territory, show everyone that he still had a seat at the table. He was still the guy you had to get through with anything to do with Australian business. But it wasn't something that he was actually all that invested in.
Which is weird, because he did like rugby league.
I mean, he liked rugby league, but had a shameful attitude to showing it on his own network.
Yeah.
But so I think the Packer part of it, I think that really did in some ways sway public perception.
Yeah.
And I think it was viewed from Optus even as an important part of their success, his political connections and all the rest of it. But regardless, with Jeff Cousins, they had someone who was going to match Kerry Packer. You know, he wouldn't back down to him. In fact, he's reported as having a go at Kerry Packer and telling him of the pay TV rights. They're not yours, they're mine. So, you know, you don't have a say.
Which any good executive would have to do, right?
Yeah. At this point, I'm going to defend Optus, because it's clearly true that any deal between Packer and Murdoch was going to screw them if they just bowed down and went along with it. You know, they had their interests to protect. And so at this point, we're going to talk about Jeff Cousins' a bit more. You heard us discuss him during the Phillip Street chapter in particular, and assorted other points along the way. So basically, April 1 was essentially his first day in the job as chief executive of Optus Vision.
Still hilarious.
So he came in and instantly committed Optus to the fight, you know, threw in a bunch of money that I think the total that Optus put in the end washed out to, you know, over $200 million, something like that. It was a lot of money. And because of that, he's viewed by people in the ARL as being this hero, this savior. Phil Gould described him as the gun that turned out to be a cannon. Arthurson said, "If you're in the trenches at Gallipoli, you could have no one better alongside you than Jeff Cousins."
Well, he's a great judge of character because his best mate, Kerry Packer, stabbed him in the back twice.
But the way he's talked about on the ARL side and the Optus Vision side, it just infuriates me. This was also in Mike Coleman's book. This is Tom Barnett, who was another Optus Vision executive. He believed in what he was doing. He believed sport must be run by the people for the people, not by a corporation. I know it sounds like just another pitch from an old ad man, but he honestly believed it. He said, "This is wrong. This can't happen." And he wasn't prepared to walk away. Not ever. He didn't flinch once.
He's a regular Leon Trotsky, isn't he?
And so if News Limited weren't giving any ground on the way they wanted the competition run, Jeff Cousins was giving up no ground at all in terms of compromise and doing any deal that was going to affect Optus Vision's bottom line.
We're into hypothetical territory again, but I mean, if they just gave them something in return just to bow out, you know, in the compromise, News Limited and Packer gave Optus Vision some sort of content or something, here you go.
Yeah, yeah. Like, it'd have to be some buyout or, yeah, it would have to be something significant. But they didn't get to the stage of offering that, and it's hard to see what agreement Cousins would have agreed to, especially given how much money they'd already poured into the fight. I mean, I guess you say don't pour good money after bad, but all his public statements were just resolute, you know, saying that we want to see the court case continue. We want to see the ARL win it, and we don't plan to make any accommodations with News Limited in the interim. No one can make a deal unless we agree. Murdoch came along because he wanted those TV rights. The only way it can be resolved if there's negotiation with us on those rights. So he's constantly in the press with these statements. I think behind the scenes, even more, he would have been pressing the point that they weren't going to be doing a deal.
Well, let me ask you this. Why are they carrying on with all these discussions if they're just excluding him?
That is a very good question. I mean, nominally, this was the third step in that process that I was talking about. So step one was Packer and Murdoch coming to agreement. Step two was the ARL and News Limited coming to an agreement. But step three was the one that had to happen. And I mean, as it turned out, they didn't even get step two sorted. But it was all pointless. We went through all of this month-long battle, this, you know, what were the two Kens even talking to each other about if ultimately it was all going to come down to Optus Vision?
Yeah, it's odd, isn't it? I suppose they were probably thinking, start the dialogue now, it's going to work itself out.
Yeah, exactly. I think it was, if we put everything into place, if we have a competition that, you know, let's just say they did go with that, the two tiers, the Gilton and Shield and the Super League on the top. I mean, maybe you could have come to an arrangement where Optus had the Gilton and Shield and Foxtel had the Super League, or maybe even a shared agreement where, you know, both networks had, you know, Super League games shown. I don't know, maybe they could have come up with an agreement that was acceptable to Optus Vision, but it seems like you start with that.
Yeah.
But so regardless, a deal couldn't be done. And I don't blame Jeff Cousins for standing his ground.
Me either.
I consider him one of the true villains of the saga because of the way his actions prevented peace. But I don't blame him for doing the best for Optus Vision. What I don't like is framing it as this moral crusade.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, Packer had the rights given to him for some unknown reason and then onsold them. If he didn't onsell them, it would have been be able to be worked out, you know. So yet again, he's involved in the game's destruction.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, I believe Jeff Cousins should be equally as reviled as Packer and Murdoch.
Yeah, well, I don't, because I mean, he's just defending his company's position. I think he's a step below both of them. Just the fact that he's the sticking point.
Yeah, yeah. I guess, yeah, the big thing for me, it's always his finger jamming the works. anytime something could have been done. But I accept that in some ways this is unfair, especially at this point. Like, his resistance was moot because the ARL never found an acceptable agreement with News Limited. So all the talks that were being going on to then present something to Optus Vision, they never got to that stage. But that goes to this three-step plan where step two was completely unnecessary. If they'd just done an agreement between Packer and Murdoch, and then those two bypassing the ARL completely, going straight to Optus Vision and doing a deal, well, the ARL would have no choice but to accept what they were offered. So that's another way it could have broken.
Just a sad state of affairs, that's what it is.
But regardless of that, the talks between the two Kens finally broke down on the 29th of November, with Ken Arthurson writing to Ken Cowley and saying, "I don't feel we've moved to any significant extent from the position which you presented to me 2 weeks ago." So that was basically it. They never got anywhere near where each party wanted to be.
Well, the options were like the ball gag from Pulp Fiction or nothing. It's like not really fair negotiations from Cowley.
Well, in Cowley's response to Arthurson, he said this: "The responsibility for negotiating a settlement rests with us. This is a responsibility which I've accepted and which I've acknowledged in our discussions. News and Channel 9 have joined together to facilitate the reconciliation, and each is willing to make significant concessions, as has been discussed. In recognition of those concessions, the ARL must now also put the interests of the game above personal and corporate interests to position itself on the side of compromise." Which is another subtle dig at Optus, I think, saying that News and Channel 9 have come together.
What about the fact that, like, Murdoch owned a percentage of Channel 7 as well? So much murkiness.
I know. And then there's the Fairfax part of it all where, like, you know, both of them were trying to get stakes and sell the... I'm really interested in the business part of it all, but I feel, like, really unqualified to discuss it at any length. But I think if we're having a go at all the parties involved, I think it's high time that Ken Cowley comes under the microscope as well. Because if Kerry Packer is falsely viewed as the knockabout, every article ever written about Ken Cowley positions him as, you know, old school, soul of the earth, as good as his word, all the rest of it. And it's like he is as self-interested as every other party involved. You know, he's all like, "I said to Rupert, we can't stuff up this game in Australia." It's like, you know, thanks, mate.
At least he's got the self-made part of it. It wasn't old money, you know?
No, yeah. So, I mean, even that part of it, it's like there's all these stories of him. You know, he grew up in a tent on the Georges River, educated at Bankstown High. But, I mean, like, he's a multi-millionaire who, at one point in 1995, there was a potential deal for him to buy the Australian arm of News Limited outright. You know, after the war, he resigned from News Limited to take on chairmanship and ownership of RM Williams just as a retirement job.
Yeah.
So what was best for News Limited is what was best for Ken Cowley, and that's what he was always going to do.
Again, though, you got to fight for your company. It's otherwise, you're as traitorous as the rest of them.
Yeah, yeah, true.
Same as Cousins.
So, yeah, no, I've come around a bit to your way of thinking on Cousins. Maybe he's a lesser tier of villain than Packer and Murdoch. But back to Packer and Murdoch. The failure to reach compromise and to get Optus to come to an agreement led to the collapse of the deal that they had broken in early November. So that meant the collapse of the Fox movies and TV and all the rest of it. That ended up in the courts and led to the famous quote by Rupert Murdoch calling Kerry Packer a Welsher.
Like, that term is, you know, like calling a criminal a dog, you know. It's like the worst term you could have down the pub. He welched on his bet for the for the carton that we had, you know, on the weekend. It's like, yeah, amongst those two animals, like, what does that mean?
Exactly. Like, I mean, in Packer's defense, I don't think he did welch on the deal. He did his part to, you know, bring the compromise to fruition. It couldn't work out. So I don't think he's a welcher in this deal, but, like, I'm sure he's welched on a billion other deals in the, you know, 40 years in business preceding that. Like, he absolutely would have welched if it was advantageous to him.
Oh, that's just, like, hilarious. Two multi-billionaires.
And that quote also, like, highlighted Arco's continued naivety in his book, saying, "The first deal fell through in the wake of squabbling between the billionaires Packer and Murdoch, during which Murdoch called Packer a welcher. A year or so later, he was back to being an honourable, upright business gentleman in Murdoch's eyes, referring to the fact that they came back together and did a deal. It's like, no, neither of these men thinks in those terms at all of each other or of anyone else.
I think naivety is the correct word there.
I mean, even in the face of everything he'd been through, like, on the one hand, it's endearing, but on the other, it's an indictable offence, you know? Like, he's a rugby league man to his core, and that's to be commended. But, like, surely a man in his position in the game should be expected to have some nous.
Yeah, I mean, especially when you saw World Series cricket, like, years earlier.
But Arthurson wasn't alone in this from the ARL side. So in 1996, in an SMH article, a senior ARL official is reported defending Packer, saying, "Murdoch's man," referring to Ken Cowley, "made the peace plan unacceptable rather than Packer Welsh on a deal." And it's like, well, yeah, that's true, but like, Packer just fucked you over. Why are you going out of your way to defend him against claims of being a Welsher?
He had some sort of magnetism where people wanted to be on his good side.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess it was still in the ARL's interest to be on Packer's good side. But it's just like 2 months before that, the ARL were accusing Packer of treachery. And now they're going out of the way to, like, who cares if he's a Welsher? Why does he need to be defended on that?
Very much Stockholm syndrome to me.
And then during 1996, Packer's offsider Graham Richardson got back involved, holding talks with Kevin Neill at Canberra, various figures at Brisbane about a possible compromise. These talks were done with no consultation with or knowledge by the ARL. So this was completely, you know, this guy who was there in the trenches and, you know, he was up for the fight in 1995, went out to talk to Super League clubs in 1996. And I dare say he wasn't doing that off his own bat. And if it wasn't the ARL, then I think it's fair to say that Kerry Packer had something to do with that as well.
He really makes my skin crawl, Graham Richardson.
I know. And then, of course, in 1997, after the collapse of this first deal, Packer and Murdoch came together yet again with Channel 9 getting the free-to-air rights for Super League.
What was Super League thinking when they're looking at Packer's coverage of the ARL for so many years, Burke's Backyard, the 43-minute Sunday game? Well, they think this guy's going to be great for our product.
And I mean, this is for another episode, but that was to get even worse, you know, with Super League in 1997. But regardless, a deal was done and Channel 9 were the free-to-air carrier of Super League. And in Arthurson's book, he said, "On Friday, 17th of January, 1997, Channel 9 made the formal announcement of a deal with Super League. I'd heard the rumours on this, but defended our allies. Not when the chips are down. They won't do it," I'd said to people.
So obviously his acolytes were saying, "You sure? It seems like the sort of guy who would do it."
I just can't understand how someone with so much experience and someone who took the game so far could keep getting surprised by this.
Somebody who's dealt with Peter Moore for 40 years. It's not even Machiavellian because he's overtly doing it and always has.
Exactly. But before that 1997 deal, in early 1996, firmly at the time when Packer was considered a traitor by the ARL, he surprised ARL officials by making a visit to Phillip Street to pick up his season tickets.
The best part about that, he could have sent any number of assistants.
I love this image so much. And like, to be fair, he did, you know, spend an hour or so talking with Arco about various things to do with the game. But the fact that the ARL are, you know, seething at the betrayal and what he could do, how could he do this to us? He just casually walks in to pick up his season tickets as if nothing had happened. Actually, over the course of this episode, I've come even more around to the idea that he is way, 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 like, ahead of Jeff Cousins on the villain scale in this saga.
Well, he's number one on the audacity scale for that one. That's good.
But yeah, Kerry Packer, one of the all-time pricks.
Still, I mean, after all we've talked about in this series about what he's done, I still have a fondness for him anyway. I kind of get it, you know?
Oh, at least he's a sporting bloke.
That's right, you know, of the punt.
But that is the end of this chapter, and that gets us almost to the point of the court case, which is going to be a big chapter to get through. I dare say that'll be a multi-parter. Before we get to that, though, we've got a diversion that was one of my favorite things to research. Some people may wonder about why it is so crucial to the war, but I think you can't tell the story in full without this story. So that will be on our next episode. But welcome back, everyone. Thank you for everyone who has been in touch with us during the off-season, politely asking when we were going to return. Thank you all for your patience. We're pumped to be back in the saddle and recording these again.
And thank you for spreading the word, you know, with the podcast and the YouTube variations as well. We're, you know, increasing our community every week. So, you know, keep letting people know in your family and friends that you think will like the series.
Yeah, absolutely. So thanks, everyone. Thank you, Andrew. And we will speak to you next week.
Thank you, mate.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.